And we're hoping to have a conversation about, well, a number of things actually. I'd like to introduce Jennifer Cook at the end, David Lawrence, Will Alsop, Edward Schell, and Naomi Citizen from Beaconsfield. And, well, we've got a couple of things to celebrate. There's a book, this book, which you can find and indeed buy a copy of from the desk at the front, which is called In the Company of Ghosts, The Poetics of the Motorway, which, and this talk's a celebration of it. It's actually been launched. It was launched at the Poetry Library a couple of weeks ago. So we're kind of hoping to delve into some of the ideas within the book. And also, something rather special for Beaconsfield, we're launching this lovely print on the wall, which Edward Schell has made especially for us. And it's a contribution to our Fraternise scheme, and that's a fundraising scheme to which artists contribute in order to help us stay here doing things.
Stay in business.
Stay in business, as it were. So it's a wonderful thing, and it's what is it called? It's called Buttercup, isn't
Buttercup
it?
Buttercup for Elizabeth Rankin. It's actually the Creeping Buttercup.
Yeah, tell us how it's made.
It's well, I go out to the motorways, needless to say, and I'm very interested in these sort of etchlands. And this particular print came out of one of my sorties where I was driving down the M20 and decided to pull in. I spotted a big patch of dust. I thought, that's really brilliant. So I got out, parked the car in a safe area, I hastened to add, and walked down in my fluorescence. I always carry fluorescence in the car for these eventualities. And I always carry a hard hat, and I carry the proper equipment. In case I am stopped, I'm completely properly dressed. And walked down the hard shore to this patch of dust and swept it up into a series of jam jars. And actually the print is made of a buttercup, which was photographed actually on the verge, made of the dust from the M20.
I thought you were just
going to
say screen print. But
well, no, it is a screen print. The dust has been meticulously sifted and sifted. Very, very fine particulate matter to actually screen print properly. Otherwise, it would just rip the screen or
yeah.
Come out very, very regularly.
And it's worth saying also that it is stable. It's as stable as any kind
it's
of
a, yeah, any earthy, any
just because it's made of dust from the motorway doesn't mean to say it won't be here in several hundred years' time. So that's to say as well. Or you can make a reservation and you know think about it. It's very beautiful, I think. Anyway, so thank you very much for that.
That's okay.
And it's also the launch of the Olympics later on. So this is a kind of not the launch of the Olympics event as part of the South London Arts Map Gallery Consortium, where we're all open this evening late. And if you're feeling fit, then there's an after party after this event, which will be at Cul-de-sac Gallery. And could you hold up one of those pink maps, actually, Deborah? Thanks. So that's the South London Arts Map, which you're welcome to take one away with you when you go. And it's a comprehensive guide to all the galleries in South London. And we can lead you to Cul-de-sac later if you'd like to come. Anyway, back to the job in hand, which is to talk about this. And well, I think we really have to start with you, Edward, because we've already started with you.
Yeah.
But
I'm
are co-editor, aren't
yeah.
you? And it came out of a kind of meeting of minds with a poet.
Indeed, it's a poet called. Andrew Taylor, a poet based in Liverpool. He's not a very well-known poet, but he's associated with a very, very, quite well-known in the poetry world, well-known poetry press called the Bacci Press, which, interestingly enough, in Italian means weeds. We've known each other for a few years, and he happened to come down to London last year on a visit. And as these things often happen, ideas come out of just small conversations around things like kitchen tables. One morning, we just had a good breakfast and we just got talking about things that interested us, and it happened to be I just done a show with Grice Ale Arts and Little Chef in a very strange combination at a place called Ings near Windermere, and it was all to do with reflecting on the Grand Tour and the nature, the relationship between tourism and the way we image landscape. And we got talking about motorways, and we found that we had all sorts of shared stories and enthusiasms about motorways, and the book simply grew out of a conversation. And before we knew it, well, he was associated with this particular press, and we knew various people in common who might be interested to participate in this book, and it just snowballed, and everybody, or the two contributors here, for instance, David and Will, were absolutely willing to participate in this really quite strange project. It's a project that maybe a lot of publishers might not have entered into quite so quickly, because it's an odd book, and I say odd in that it's a combination of arts, architecture, psychogeography, cultural geography, social commentary, and poetry. And very often you don't get books which have that sort of mix of content. So in a sense, it happened very, very quickly. It's an odd book, and we launched it, just like Naomi was saying, just over a couple of weeks ago, at the Poetry Library, which is very fitting as part of the London Literature Festival.
But you say it's not a survey, but a starting point. It's so where do you want it to take the reader?
It's simply opening up the subject of the motorway. I mean, motorways are just one type of Edgeland. You know, Edgeland's a very peculiar place, because you get all sorts of... there's spaces which are contested. You get all sorts of cultural values, territorial values, all sorts of things which might contest those edges. And motorways, obviously, I drive down to Canterbury several days of the week. I work down at Canterbury at UCA. So I'm used to this motorway edgeland. It's part of my sort of visual vernacular. But, you know, there are other edgelands as well, which also interest me. A project I did a couple of years ago was involving the Swedenborg Society, and the edgeland there was the stairwell. And the piece I put in there, stairwell, was a handrail. Again, that is an architectural type of edgeland. So edgelands can take all sorts of forms, and in fact the edgelands in this book take all sorts of forms. David talks about the motorway service station, Will talks about a project which was the Super City M62, all types of edgelands, and bringing together collisions of ideas in their own different ways.
Of course, as a painter, it's landscape, isn't it? I mean, it's like, it's very, I mean,
yes.
as one from the same background,
yeah.
Long thought about the motorway,
yeah.
In landscape terms, and
definitely,
do,
I definitely, as a painter, I definitely think about these things in landscape terms. But then, you know, landscape is not a simple notion. We often might think of landscape as being a simple thing, like it's just a painting on a chocolate box cover on a canvas. It's actually not that. All our notions of landscapes are highly coloured by notions of, well, they essentially come in many ways from the picturesque. The picturesque was really politically loaded with notions of ownership, of things like enclosure. So it's rooted in all sorts of political oppression from the 18th century. So there's all sorts of things which can be unpacked with landscape, which are there and are ready to be unpacked.
Absolutely.
And that's what really interests me.
Yeah, yeah. So, Will, I mean, you talked about thinking about in the book that you've written, you talk about the seeds of a future greenway, and you talk about the caveat, if rail takes over. What, I mean, how likely is it that rail will take over, and when?
Well, we can't afford the rail, can we? But anyway, so that's one reason why it probably won't. And I think motorways are a part of us, and so particularly my generation, because until I was, I don't know, 14 or something, there were no motorways. And I remember the M1 only. I was born and bred in Northampton, I should understand. You should understand. And it was a great celebration when that section of the M1 opened. And people would go out on a Sunday afternoon and drive down it. And I was taken in the back of those cars, and I thought it was really exciting. And of course, at that age, and how fast you can go. And there were warnings, as I recall, that if you went down a dip and up the other side, you should not go more than 60 miles an hour, because you might pass out. Which is sort of somewhat strange, but very exciting to a 13 or 14 year old, I have to say. But of course, the other thing that fascinates me about motorways, and you refer to them as edgelands, but actually they're, in a way, they're heartlands, aren't
yeah,
they?
Because they're central to our experience.
There are things that we, I'm sure the majority of us do today, which we can only do because the motorway exists. So certainly when I was probably 12, you know, that sort of annual journey to the coast from Northampton, which is about as far away from the coast as you can get in this small country of ours, was a major event. I mean, it took a long time. And you think about stopping off for lunch somewhere, and where should we do that? And not my decision, I have to say. The cars were unreliable, and you broke down, and it was a real adventure.
Yeah.
And actually, motorways are a different type of adventure today. But they do allow us, you know, we can go to Manchester and back in a day if you want to, because it's possible, it's feasible.
Right.
And you can fill up for one of your motorways in both senses of the word, and you can also download as well. But I think that in the piece in the book, it didn't come from thinking about the M62 in particular, but the M62 came out of thinking about all the towns, cities and villages and along the M62, and how what the M62 represented to the people that live in those places. And I was also interested in the way that they didn't like to admit it. The people in Barnsley didn't like to admit that the M62 was actually quite important to them. They have a sort of sense of place, and I was interested in that Barnsley is Barnsley and they hate the people in Doncaster for some, I don't know why, but they don't seem to like them very much. But it was very important, this idea. However, people in Barnsley do recognise that the market in Doncaster is much better than their own market, which used to be brilliant. So they do go off. I imagine they sneak off down the M62 for a bit of a shop on a Saturday or whatever. And then they go off to, depending on your age, for a bit of a sort of thrash around in some club, smoking drugs and all the rest of it, in Manchester. A bit of higher end shopping in Leeds, perhaps. So they were actually using this whole strip across the country, coast to coast, if you take hold of Liverpool, almost as one city, and that interested me. And therefore the M62, what does that actually represent to this particular place? I don't think we'll be threatened with to go by train from Hull to Liverpool is nigh on impossible. You can do it, but it'll take forever. Mm-hmm. And it's all local trains, you don't know what you do. Okay, if you're old enough to have a bus pass, that's okay, because at least you think you're getting it for nothing.
Yeah.
But beyond that, if you're in a hurry, forget it. So you have no alternative but to actually drive or to be driven down the M62. And I think it's a great point of celebration. These places gather meaning as people, particularly locals, gather along, because events occur over the span of their life. And they remember them very well, as this is the place that the last place I had a picnic, which you could see from the motorway, with my dad who died, or whatever. And so they accumulate very much more value and very much more meaning than they did when they were originally built.
Is it a peculiarly, well, it is not a metropolitan experience, is it? I mean, people, we in London, who might not have a car, actually don't so often use the motorway. So it's a sort of, well, not just northern, but it's a sort of other regional experience, perhaps. Or what you're talking about, anyway, is something that's not London, that's not the metropolis.
Well, no, I'm not sure I agree with that. You might be the peculiar one.
I mean, somebody who has been up and down the motorway. I like this.
I live in London, but I do use the motorways quite frequently.
I mean, a lot of people are actually sort of fairly logged in London because for economic reasons or, whatever. You're talking about people who might be locked on the M62 for economic reasons.
Well, not only for economic reasons, but for fun, for convenience, for seeing friends, because all our friends are spread out over much wider area than they used to be.
Yeah, but I just sort of meant because it's cheaper to live outside of London. Do you see what I mean?
Oh, yeah, I see what you are.
Yeah.
Everyone's got to be to live somewhere. But,
I think, they have really affected us enormously in ways we don't often really realise. For instance, things like our shopping habits have really radically altered since things like Blue Water, Meadowhall, out-of-town shopping centres and Metro Centre, all out-of-town on major trunk roads or motorways accessible.
And looking exactly the same.
Well, the same sort of high street stores, there's this sort of cultural aporia where things, Marks and Spencer's in Blue Water is the same as it is in Eastleigh or wherever. It's the same, but it's actually accessible in Blue Water and there's lots of car parking and people drive there. And part of the experience is actually not only not shopping in a locality, shopping out of town and travelling. I mean, I travelled to Canterbury and it's 62 miles door to door as a regular sort of commute. And that, when I was a kid, like you're saying, cars were much less reliable and journeys were much longer. I remember the M62 being built and the M6 extension. A journey to the South Lakes used to take us 2.5 hours in an old Ford Pop if we were lucky. and sometimes you would get stuck in traffic behind a caravan, old, you know, old hacker radio bouncing, no in-car stereos, no clunk click every trip. It was slow, sometimes three and a half hours. It's a really long journey, it's a big adventure.
Yeah.
Now you can do it in an hour and a half. I can commute the same journey there and back in a day and think nothing of it, and people do that, I think, partly as a result of the motorways. So it's affected in all sorts of ways, our working habits, our shopping habits, you know, distribution centres all around the country. They're everywhere, and they affect every aspect of our lives.
But totally ignored.
Mm.
You know, if you take all these sort of experts, they don't pour their, I'm talking from an urbanist point of view, they put all their efforts into, you know, tiny bits of London, or, and indeed many other cities and places. They never talk about the motorways, but actually there are thousands of people spending thousands of hours on them, going up and down, and you know, they are worthy, they are a fact of life, and you know, they might breed the out-of-town shopping centre. I'm not a great fan, but they're also a fact of life.
They're a fact of life,
so it's not a value judgement, it's just saying that's the way it is.
Mm.
I don't think that's going to change, rightly or wrongly. So what do we, you know, how can we deal with that? How do you actually embrace that in some vision of the next 10, 20 years.
I
well, that was one thing. I don't want to go on about cities. I can go about cities.
Because they might not have read your essay.
Okay.
In
5 seconds.
Idea, yeah.
From Liverpool to Hull, and roughly 10 miles north and south of the M62, live 15.4 million people. Same as Holland. It's one country along the M62. And I already mentioned that people do use that link, that blood vessel, to do all sorts of things. And what I suppose really concerned me is that there is pressure. All of those myriad of towns and cities along that route are all under pressure to provide more housing. And what really I began to worry about was that most of that housing was going to be provided by the Barratts, Wimpeys and the mass house builders, and they just take up more and more precious countryside, and that worried me. I also knew from intensive work in a number of those places, particularly Barnsley, Bradford, and parts of Manchester, is that, but Barnsley is the best example, because I spent a lot of time in Barnsley, and I realised that you go beyond a certain distance from the centre of the city, and the new housing estates, those people didn't think they belonged to Barnsley. They go off and do other things. They didn't contribute anything to Barnsley. They didn't do anything with Barnsley at all. And they were just stuck there. And on one level, they were quite content, and I couldn't, you know, I have no view on that. On another level, it didn't contribute. And if we believe that we're here to at least make some contribution in our own small way, then that is not what you should do. Therefore, it seemed to me the only other the other possible solution was to just build a number of new settlements along the M62. It's about identity. It's about a sense of belonging to a particular place, and then another sense of belonging to this new city, which I call Super City, for want of a better word, basically stretched out along the M62. I knew it would be successful. Then when Leeds United fell out of the cup, the people in Leeds would support Manchester City, maybe. Then you'd really win, wouldn't you? There's some sense of community.
I mean, old cities were built along rivers, so that would be using the motorway as a kind of old river system in a way.
Mm. Absolutely.
To do the same thing. If you look at old villages, that, you know, they run along.
It's interesting.
You see, the concept though was to take the cars off the M62.
Right.
So you live, and then you'd drive to more service stations,
yeah.
Then you deal with the service stations as real meeting places for telling stories, for bits of shopping, for all sorts of, you know, for eating well. No,
radical.
It could be done, why not? It could be to do with education, it could be all sorts of things.
Mm.
And then there'd be these super buses, frequent, comfortable,
okay,
with lavatories on them, very important. And they would take you up and down, and you just allow the truck, so that the private car, you just use the A and the B roads to get to these
so
these
it's park and ride motorways.
Well,
in a sense, but really comfortable.
Yeah.
You know, you'll park and ride that one at Oxford.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
You could die in that place.
But that would also contribute to the green agenda, because you could run those buses ecologically, I guess.
You would indeed, yeah.
But strangely, these relationships between major trunk systems have always happened, in fact, going back to the 18th century. When the Manchester Ship Canal was first postulated and built, it was actually called the Grand Trunk. between Liverpool and Manchester, and actually a lot of the commerce and Manchester was actually a big docks as well, went up and with people as well. So it, these things act like a sort of blood system, and in many ways, you could say, well, our motorways are a sort of ventricular system for the country economically and in all sorts of, but maybe social ways as well. In fact, I mean, it's not only things like the old Yorkiad, which some of you probably who are old enough to remember the old Yorkiads driving, pounding the coast from pounding the road from coast to coast. You might remember more recently there was a Transit Vanad where they used the vernacular of the Pennines, backbone of Britain, and it zoomed out on the transit vans, zooming up and down the motorway, probably the M1, zooming out to satellite shot, you can see the mountains, backbone of Britain. Great idea. We can readily associate the motorway, the backbone, and this system of vans going up and down, transporting goods. It's brilliantly fascinating.
David, you're really interested in the stopping places, aren't you, rather than the moving bit?
Yeah, I think so. I grew up in suburban West London, and I never went anywhere by car. We didn't even have a Ford Pop, I don't think. But I was given books by friends like On the Road, Jack Kerouac, that kind of thing. And as I got older, I realised that there was more to Britain than Twickenham and Kingston in West London. Fantasy even. So I wanted to get out. And I eventually got, I think, girlfriends who had cars that would occasionally drive me to these places. And I discovered that there was this whole other world that somehow mirrored my suburban existence, but was other and different. And I did some work with the 20th Century Society on looking at post-war buildings in terms of their listing, and we actually had a coach trip up the M6 up to the Lake District and back one afternoon from Birmingham, which was fantastic. And I also took some people on holiday up the M1 on another occasion.
That's right.
It was fantastic. And then I realised that I put a book together that was all about these places. But then I realised that there was another side to it that I hadn't been able to cover, and that was the kind of the nighttime geography. It's another kind of park and ride, I guess, that goes on at these places. And so I began to live at service stations, and I spent a week at Washington Birtley over Christmas one year on the A1M. I've stayed at South Mimms, and I used to take the train to the nearest station, then go by Brompton bicycle to the travel lodge, and then set up in the travel lodge for a week with all of my kind of research materials and the TV, and then just watch people, spend every day going out watching people wandering around the service station, doing things like litter picks. I know we've talked a little bit about cultural archaeology. Mm-hmm. Going down the bins at a service station, particularly in the car park, is a very good way to discover what's going on. Or what
so,
has gone
so
on.
So were these trips primarily work or pleasure, would you say?
Yes. Well, I found there was a synergy between the two. One has to be careful. But I don't know, there's a huge, huge amount of boredom, but I realised I've never really accepted that most of life is about boredom, and occasionally there are these exciting bits, and it's like driving along the motorway, which is very boring, and listening to one's own stereo, and then stopping and ducking into everybody else's life. And that's yes, it's that kind of interstitial bit between all of the banality that's exciting, and it's just about looking below the surface, really, and see what's going on.
And that come back. Yes. Just seems a good moment to bring Jennifer in, because isn't South Mimms, this has already been mentioned, isn't South Mimms the place from which the poem we're going to hear later comes, or is it just a bit of the poem?
No, well, that's a difficult question. The poem is set at South Mimms. I should probably say, I really hate motorways.
I was about to ask you that. Can I ask a question? Is this all very blokish? Is this
a kind of... I hate cars so much. And when I moved to London from Leicester, and I had to have a car in Leicester because the infrastructure just isn't there in the same way for the buses and the trains for what I needed to do. And I got to London we arrived on Friday night, and I was at some kind of barbecue on Sunday. And I just said, look, does anyone want a car? and I gave it away. It wasn't just about to fail its MOT, and I was clear about that. But nevertheless, I got rid of it as soon as I got here, and I was so relieved. And I was like, that's it, you know, no more sitting on... And I've spent a lot of time sitting on the M40 and the M25 particularly. I used to sometimes commute from Brighton to Middlesex University, and that was hellish. So I genuinely hate them. I don't like driving. I don't like motorway. I don't like what happens. I don't like driving. I don't like being a passenger. If I can read a book, I'm fine. But I'm not interested, and I think they're boring. But South Mimms was quite important to me as a teenager because it was 24 hours. And so you could go there at any time of the night after the pubs had closed or wherever. And so groups of us, and probably looking, you know, thinking about it now, we're probably kind of awful, annoying teenagers who were probably, you know, slightly, I don't know, just irritating probably for the people who worked there. But we used to go and hang out there for hours, drinking coffee, talking about nothing probably, flirting with each other. And you couldn't buy, we still can't buy alcohol at South Mimms service station, annoyingly. Marks and Spencer's doesn't sell wine at service stations because we're all so irresponsible that we immediately just crack it open, glug it down, and then crash into something. So you can't buy alcohol at service stations, which I think is this weird zone of kind of policing of public behaviour. But anyway, so South Mimms is kind of important to me as a place, and the poem's a political poem, or at least that's how I think about it. And I wanted to think about a space where it would be the kind of least likely public space where a revolution would start. So I needed somewhere that was, which was anonymous, but also where people were not going to come together, which is service stations. People don't ever meet anyone in a service station. You maybe are the only exception to this.
Well, we did.
There are lots of people who do meet.
A couple of people around the table. Yeah.
There are lots of people who do meet at service stations. They just don't tell anybody else about it. I think that's
yeah, but maybe they pre-arranged
it.
To meet there
yes,
for
yeah.
drug swaps or for, I don't know, an awful blind date or something. But the fact is you don't bump into a stranger and kind of think, wow, it's so interesting talking to you over yellow food. So it's not, I wanted somewhere where it was kind of really impossible for anything political to be imagined really, and then to try and imagine what that might be like. And it was written before the student student protests in 2010-11 and before the riots as well, and it kind of felt, reading the poem in the wake of those things, that it had captured something of both the impossible hope of those things, but also their futility. And it was about trying to stage some of the scaffolding is about politics and political spaces as spaces that are also spaces of education. If you spend any time working in sort of protest politics, you have to go to educative workshops of one kind or another, whether it's what to do if you're arrested, or whether it's sort of green agendas or whatever. There's a whole load of educative scaffolding that comes with it. So some of that's reflected in the book, and then kind of also moved through other types of improvement, self-improvement, for example, in one poem. So it's hinged at the beginning and the end by a revolutionary moment, one that's led by a woman who's born out of an egg that's born out of a woman that becomes a leader for the revolution, and then it kind of moves various ways amongst those spaces. But the research we did for the, because it's a, as you'll see later, it's a music and poetry piece, and the music was done by a composer who I was working with, and we went on a field trip from Leicester where we were living. We both lived in Leicester, and I said, well, I'll drive us down to South Mimms for an evening. and we took a dictaphone, and we took a camera, and we drove for, I think it turned out to be about 2.5 hours down the M1, and then you know, sort of got to South Mimms, ate a variety of quite awful food, and hung out there for a few hours. And it's quite, I mean, you'll be very familiar with this, but it's very strange spending time in a space which is designed for you not to spend time in it for very long. So after about 40 minutes, people start to look at you because you're not really supposed to be there longer than the ability to eat a meal, have a pee, and I don't know, you know, buy a gift, complain about the fact there's no wine, something, I don't know. And so it being there for sort of 3 or 4 hours and recording things and photographing things, people get a bit, and no one can actually say to you, you can't be here. And from the point of view of the poem, that was interesting, because actually it seemed to have, the experience of being there seemed to have more possibility than I'd thought originally, just sitting at home thinking about it, because actually no one was going to come across and say, I don't know what you were doing here, but it's not what everyone else is doing, it's wrong. Because it clearly wasn't wrong, we weren't doing anything wrong, we were abiding by all the rules, but we were attracting attention because we were using the space in a way it wasn't designed to be used. And that was quite interesting, and we recorded lots of soundtracks, and some of those soundtracks appear in various ways in the soundtrack that I read over, when the soundscape that the poem has. And so that was kind of interesting. There were a load of images we took as well, but I've never put them together into anything, and I'm quite glad, because these are really good. Mine are terrible. It would have been awful to do that. But so the research actually changed the writing and the work that both of us did, both the composer and me as the writer, because actually being there was quite a strange experience.
So it wasn't as it wasn't so alienating as you thought. David, back to your idea of everyday relationships as geography. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, I was
Jennifer sort of saying, don't have everyday relationships there, right, almost.
But I think this is part of the geography, and just hearing your story, my map gets ever more populated, and I think that's the point, really. That's what I was trying to do with the study, and that's what the map's at the end of this show, is looking at how people do behave when they believe they're anonymous. Mm. People are much more themselves, in a way, when they feel like they're in a crowd. Yet it's a relatively compact place to be. Because it's defined by the perimeter of the motorway and the car parks, people can't go that far. But there are places that people go to. There are the boundaries, the edges of the car parks, behind the buildings, in the shops, and there are lots of different things going on. You've got the strangers drifting through, people stopping for maybe 3 or 4 hours who don't get thrown out, so there are all kinds of curious things going on. People exchange their kids at the motorway service stations, traffic cops meet there, people hand over money from horse racing wins at service stations in carrier bags. So lots of lots of curious things going on. And then there are the people that operate them, who we think of as being faceless, horrible corporate characters, and most of them are somewhere near the top. It's a Bahraini bank these days that runs these places. But the managers, the site managers and the staff who work there have often been there for years and years and years, and they love the place. They live it. They're much more excited about being there than they are about working for Locog over at Stratford at the moment. There are generations of families work at these places. So in a way they come back to Will's idea of being little towns in themselves. They are the new villages. They're the motorway served villages that people come to every day.
See, people feel safe there. So the way you're describing it, it sounds like quite a safe place.
It's nearly always police.
I think they're slightly. They don't feel that safe to me somehow.
Well, they're no less safe or more expensive than any London railway station, for example. You know, they're just somewhere that seems a bit strange out in the countryside, but they're perfectly reasonable places in their own way. They're just these strange developments because they're hanging off the motorway. But there are people who live nearby. Some of the service stations, particularly say the M1 through Northampton now, there are lots of satellite estates developed off the roundabouts, off the junctions, off the M1. And those people can hop over the fence, walk along the verge for a bit, and they're at the service station. It's the nearest place to buy milk or a paper. You might not be able to buy wine there, but you can get most other things. You know. So they're in the way that H.G. Wells, for example, said that one day Britain would be a suburbia crisscrossed by roads with little population nodes at each crossroads. That's what we're getting with service stations. And they are really interesting places to kind of dig below the surface of society and see what people are really up to.
Do you think there's a class element to service stations? Because when I was living in Leicester and going further north, I've just noticed that the service stations were a bit less shishy.
Further north?
Yeah, and you come down south and it's like, oh, there's a bit of a Waitrose here or an M&S or whatever. And there's a kind of, I've really noticed that there was sort of, that the southern belt had...
It's quite recent, more, isn't it?
Yes, it is quite recent.
Isn't M&S, Waitrose and Starbucks and everything, that's kind of...
I think there's
move
more...
On. Well,
but it hasn't migrated north in quite the same way, or it hadn't, I'm now moved here 7 years ago, but it hadn't at that point moved...
I think there tends to be more money in the south, perhaps, so these operations can, they're worth putting in, because they're very expensive franchises, that's why they're there. It's not really a real Waitrose, someone's bought
they're
the right...
franchises.
Yeah, they're franchises, so it's just a sign. And that's another thing that's lovely about these places, and this goes back to the work of people like Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown, Will Alsop, an architectural practice called FACT. These are just collections of signs, from the road sign to the thing on the toilet that says don't put any waste whatever down here. It's just signs all the time telling us what to do. It's a visual language which we either flow through or we're assaulted by in these spaces, and you could almost blow them and they just fall down. So that's another kind of visual poetry, is it's just instructions all the time, buy this, come here, do that. And the franchises are, because when we're driving, our memories are often wiped out. We don't remember that there's a really lovely Granada on the M62, but we do know what a Waitrose or an M&S is, or a Starbucks.
There are some exceptions, aren't there? from the power stand currently, but I mean, there's one on the...
T-Bay, the M6.
TBMs, is that the one with the western?
With the yacht.
The village.
With the lake.
Yes, yeah. Oh, Killington Lake.
Killington.
Yeah. There were very
so
few.
I'll wait, I'll hang on for a pee until I get to
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Because it's a more pleasant
one. Yes.
Well, you can get your hair cut at TBMs, can't you? You can do everything. Have a shirt, haircut, shoes polished. Mm. And it's like, it is a really minor village.
But historically, there used to be, in the early days of the M1, Watford Gap had a certain notoriety.
Yeah.
Because that's where all the bands from London who are performing in Birmingham, they'll stop there in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
You know, there's some quite well-known bands who do that on their way back home, and vice versa, presumably. But so I've forgotten one whole episode of my life, actually. When I was, I don't know, 16, 17, my job was at Newport Pagnell.
Okay, yeah, Forte's.
And there was the bridge across the motorway. It was very exciting in the way, because you see the travel. My job was to clean the floor.
Wow.
On the bridge. And you do it at night. It was a thankless task.
Yes.
Because there were people going over your clean floor. You thought, fuck off, you know. I just cleaned that.
Yeah.
Let it dry. But there was some, that was basically a night time job.
Yeah. Well,
but it was, there were always people.
Yeah. There were, initially there were only two of these places in the whole country, Watford Gap and Newport Pagnell. Watford Gap, and the government decided, these were run by the government, which is partly why they were expensive. So they were kind of quasi-nationalist, national places. The government decided that Watford Gap would be for the truckers and the poor people, and Newport Pagnell would be for the people with a bit of money, and it had a steak bar and things like that.
Made no difference to wages, I tell you.
No, I'm sure. And Newport Pagnell was run by the people that owned the Criterion Brasserie.
Wow.
And the Regent Palace Hotel at one time. It was the same firm.
Why did they decide that one would be for poor people? Was it to do with location, or was it to do with the kinds of things that they...
There was a real concern that the classes didn't want to mix. And until about 1970, there were separate cafes for the different classes of motorists. Seriously. So if you were fairly moneyed, you would be greeted from your car by a uniformed member of staff, like an air hostess, and taken up to the steak room. If you were perhaps not moneyed, or you rolled up in a scrappy old car, then you would be directed to the cafeteria or the trucker's cafe. And in fact, the trucker's cafe at Hilton Park became the exclusive place that people who really liked their motorway breakfasts ended up going to, if there was only one left. So people would drive a long way to do that.
So in Super City, would there be this kind of class divide? How would it work?
Well, I suppose, projecting forward, I saw that the you probably wouldn't call it a service area anymore. It would have a name like Richard or Dave, and it would be a proper place. And in other words, it would be a new settlement where you haven't been able to leave your car and do other things.
Oh yes, absolutely. And if you,
well, there's an opportunity to do that, and you're not messing anything up. You're just building on something that's already there. And
so you use existing, for instance, using existing service stations almost because they're no longer.
You'd expand it a little bit, and then you'd add to it, and then go up a bit, maybe. I mean, there's all sorts of things you could do with it. But I'm very interested in the sort of really the quality of experience and the quality of place that we establish. And I'm interested in these places because very often the so-called experts have nothing to do with them. You know, well, that just happens, you know, or the motorway just happens. And we'll concentrate on these other places. And you know, because you're a committed London type, you know, as I suppose I am, really. But I mean, there are lots of places in this city that have received all sorts, I mean, thousands of hours of contemplation by so-called experts. Okay? And then you look at them and you think, they should be better. Yeah, I mean, you really do. And
like the Millennium Dome.
Well, it's funny you should mention that. I mean, the dome itself, I like the dome itself. It has a marvellous underground station done by a wonderful architect, of course. But then everything on top is somehow sterile. But I can assure you there are thousands of hours of contemplation and expertise poured onto that. And these almost cancel each other out. And so there's one part, what I like about motorways and the things associated with motorways is they haven't had thousands of hours built. They are what they are. And there's sort of honesty to that. They could be better. I'm not saying they're brilliant pieces of thing, but actually you could just build on that because no one cares about them. Therefore there's an opportunity. When you come to a London or any of the big cities, major spaces in there you're trying to create, they're just over-considered, or you might say over-designed, which actually means they're not designed at all in some sort of ways. And there's a strong case, I think, for under-designing things, really.
When I went to South Mimms for the research trip, it was a completely different South Mimms than the one I remembered, which had burnt down in the interim and then been rebuilt. And it was rebuilt.
Nothing to do with you smoking or anything?
No.
Okay.
No. Well, I don't think so. I think it burnt down long after I'd stopped being a teenager. Well, actually, I know why it was burnt down, because Julie's pantry set it alight and it burned to the ground.
That's what I wanted.
And it had been completely rebuilt, and it was rebuilt as this sort of very, it's a very glass space with sort of news flat screens on the pillars, and it was completely different. What I thought it would be like was this sort of plastic, you know, fixed plastic chairs and tables that kind of grow out of the ground and are unfixed and that are unmovable, and that, you know, it was very plasticky and a bit grim, really. And I sort of wanted it to be like that, and it wasn't. It was all modern, and it was all sort of glass and plant pots everywhere, and sort of steel gird. And it had been, I mean, steel girders are there, which is one of the reasons for the title of the poem. And it had been properly designed, whereas the one before didn't feel like it had been given much thought. I don't know.
But you're already introducing a note of nostalgia to something that we understand to be super modern, and I think that's again something I was interested in, the way these places are now part of our society and our psyche as a culture. The South Mimms was actually inspired by North Greenwich Tube Station. It's taking that.
What, the new
yeah,
South
that
Mimms.
Kind of late 1990s. Shiny, steely, let's
really?
Make it European kind of
cultural
statement.
Send them a bill.
it's like a third generation copy of late modernity.
I think it's nostalgia though. I mean, I don't like it now, but I didn't like it then.
Okay, you sounded like you were longing for the old one, and when you got
well,
there, it wasn't really
like
that.
I wanted it to be like that, because
yeah,
I wanted it
yeah.
to reactivate memories, but
yes.
I wasn't particularly upset. I didn't like it the first time round. I'd rather
yeah.
have sat in a pub, but they didn't open long enough.
That sounds like nostalgia to me. But it's funny, you and I, David, were at an interview for Radio 4 recently at South Mimms, and talking of the shabby chic and these strange things that happen at the periphery, we met a strange German couple who were having a picnic bought from another little bolt-on cafeteria bar, which is like a caravan just outside on the slip road, and with a cup of tea, and both on deck chairs, just on a patch of green by the car park. It was just like an installation. It's absolutely fantastic. So we had to photograph them, of course. We asked their permission. And we, you know, we said, well, we're just very interested. We've just done a book, and we might well use it in another book. Could we possibly photograph you? And they were really obliging. They couldn't. They just thought we're eccentric Brits, but it was.
And you thought they were eccentric Germans.
And they were completely eccentric. They sat there with all the regalia, napkins, everything. It was so formal.
I like that.
And it was beautiful, absolutely beautiful, wasn't it?
And what they've got right in, well, I say they've got right in Germany, certainly on the autobahns, particularly in the east, is there are usually sex shops at the service stations and often discotheques. So they get close to this idea of useful places, which are about downloading and uploading or whatever it was you called it, filling up kind of thing. So that they understand that people have particular agendas, maybe interests as they drift through. So as well as being able to buy a pint of milk, you can pick up a few other things.
It's not something they call them Rastoff or rest station.
No, exactly. Yeah, and the idea originally comes from the Romans, who had these places a day's march apart, and they would have every kind of service possible for the soldiers to make sure that the armies kept marching.
If Will had his way, then those sort of places would be eliminated along the M62, at least, would they?
No, he'd add to them, wouldn't he?
They would evolve.
But you know, the idea of a stopping off place, it wouldn't be that anymore, would it?
Most of them built, assuming, as has already been said, people are not going to spend a huge amount of time there. You know. Half an hour let me finish. Half an hour on average, and therefore, you know, because people do design these places, you know, whoever they are, and I think we've got an idea who they are, and you know, it's good. I mean, it's a similar sort of psychology to the original McDonald's, you know, where the seats are not like that, they're like that. So they're comfortable when you first sit down, but after about 20 minutes, they're really not comfortable. It's time to move on, and it was done with that sort of psychology. But on the other hand, if you assume that people are not in a hurry, then you do it in a completely different way, wouldn't you? So it's all related. Everything we do anyway is related to time. And the notion of having time, then you respond in a different way. And that's why I'm interested in the service station which you mentioned. I've forgotten the
Killington Lake.
It's like they put the lake in. There are ducks. There are places to sit by the lake. As though you might actually spend a reasonable amount of time on a fine day, and actually it's not bad. Well, that's quite pleasant, and actually it's more refreshing than the cup of coffee you get inside the place, or at least you carry it out. And I think that's important. So you begin to think, what is good for you? You could spend time. You know, most people are unemployed these days, so they've got time.
French service stations are very different from ours. I mean, I was there recently, having not been for 20 years. I was flabbergasted. It was so civilized. I mean, restful. You know, they were restful places.
I think perhaps there's a difference. I've done a fair bit of travelling in France in the last few years, and there seems to be a different attitude towards the food. For a start, the food's got to be good, and they like to have a meal and enjoy it. I think the whole problem with service stations here for years, and this is again a kind of comment on English society, is that it was only the highway engineers and the civil servants that came up with this idea of a 25-minute stop, because they want us to keep moving, they want the traffic to keep flowing. Service stations were, because we might break down, we might need the toilet, or a kid might be sick. There's no other reason for them. They're just a safety thing to prevent people crashing. But what these guys, the operators, have realised, and why they fill these strange buildings with all these sideshows, and you can sit there for 4 hours, is that the longer we're there, the more we're likely to spend. So it's actually in the interests of the service station owners to detain us for longer, to give us a duck pond, to give us some nice food to eat, because the longer we're there, the more money we'll spend. So they want the service stations to be destinations. And it's only the government that doesn't want them to be destinations, which is why they limit the size of them. But there's no reason why they can't be perfectly reasonable places to go for themselves, to meet other people. I met people who had affairs. They lived in different parts of the country, and they would meet at the service station. That was where they were able to have their trysts, as it were. And unfortunately, they couldn't have a nice meal afterwards or before. So maybe we just think about, you know, improving.
Yeah, that's
quite sexual. Well, I think in England so often we ignore the quality of improving these everyday spaces.
Mm.
Even things like bus stations are badly
built. Yeah, no, I mean that seminal British film, Brief Encounter,
yes,
filmed on Carnforth Station, which is now a listed building.
Yes,
it still has its clock. So that wonderful rhapsodic music of Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto, so, you know, got Trevor Howard, Celia Johnson, it's all just this orchestrated concerto of sound, it's fantastic, and emotion.
Yes.
And it's all sort of unfulfilled. It's a masterpiece of black and white cinema. If that was to happen today, you know, imagine it might not be a railway station, but it just might be someone like Tram Services,
yeah,
possibly with the music of, I don't know, possibly 10cc, I'm Not in Love, or maybe more modern, I don't know, Massive Attack or band like that, the lyrical ballads. I can imagine it being set in a motorway service station rather than a railway station.
There is a service station just south of Newcastle with a village on either side of the motorway, and people would have affairs, inter-village affairs, and they would meet for dinner at the service station.
Is that Washington Berkeley?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God, it was you! And that really would be coming to the coming to the restaurant, over one from the car park, one over the bridge,
yeah,
having the evening together, and then back over the bridge and off.
There are tremendous views from there as well.
Yeah.
So it's got staggering landscape.
You're about to embark on an even bigger project, aren't you, called Softest Day?
It's called Softest Day, which is using the motorway edgeland, which can incorporate service stations, car parks, the motorway verges, the landscape, which is sort of enshrined by our experience of motorway travel, and essentially how that motorway travel frames our experience of landscape. So in a sense, it's about framing, and it's also looking at antecedents, how the 17th and 18th century landscape tradition has informed both motorway production. Owen Williams, you know, went to Central Park to study the plans, the road layouts of Central Park and things, which were influenced on British, English landscape design. So there's a long, long history with motorway design. It goes right back to English landscape gardens. It's picking and delving around that, with all the sort of political ramifications that that holds. Very, very interesting. So that's what that project is going to be about.
That's intriguing. Because there is a role here for the civil engineer.
Definitely.
They actually design the motorways. Mm. I remember there was a time when I travelled to Cardiff a lot, so the M4 was my friend, sort of. And I remember picking one of these engineers up from Reading, which is where they were based, and driving to Cardiff. And he'd been a part of the team that designed it. And he was fascinating because he told me all sorts of things about the M4, which we would never know. But once you know it, it's kind of interesting. He'd talk about a particular cattle bridge.
Yeah.
There's a real fight with the farmer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so suddenly that takes on another sort of meaning. And I can point it out to you if you're travelling down the M4 now, so you don't forget that. But the M4 is designed with health and safety in mind. And that's why there are very few straights on
exactly.
The M4. Mm. It's just all curved. And they engineered a thing called the rolling camber, because normally a road goes like that and the rain drains off either side. Mm. But of course, if you've got curves, they have these diagonal sort of cambers, so you'd be like that, and then it would go like that.
Mm-hmm.
But they, in one part, they got that wrong. So the first time there was a police chase down this particular, the police car turned over because actually the change of angle was too abrupt. I thought that was quite good, actually. But you know, this notion of keeping you awake because you don't have long straight lines to drive along was a definite part of the design.
Yeah.
And then you've got all the bridges. On the M1, of course,
yeah,
all the original bridges were by, what's his name, the engineer?
Owen Williams.
Owen Williams.
Mm. Who did it? Who actually?
And of course, now they're widening parts of it. They've had to, you know, if we listed these buildings, they could never widen the M1, or this is these bridges.
Right.
It's tempting to do that.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Just
yeah.
A little
then they'd have to be cleverer, wouldn't
yeah.
They? They'd have to think again.
You get around the outside.
Mm. Or on top, which has always been a constant debate.
It's actually OMT who actually invented this curve that you just very amply described, they call the clothoid curve,
yeah,
which allowed drivers to slow down and speed up. And in a sense, subconsciously we're slowing down and speeding up, continually through our motorway travel. And in a sense, it is like a speed up version of driving to a country park where there are reveals, things that countryside is revealed, enclosed by a ravine or a cutting. We go through a tunnel and something else is revealed from a different angle. So there's all this sort of implicit parallax as well involved, which again, people at Comfrey Excellent Capability Ground were really intrigued by the idea of a moving painting.
Composition.
And the beautiful thing about the service station is you're still going at 70 miles an hour in your head when you arrive. So it's like crashing into water, and it's wonderful watching
how
people. Everything slows down, and everything becomes much more vivid and vital as we move through these spaces. Having been in control of the car and feeling that everything is at our fingertips, our own music, adjusting the seats, the windscreen, whatever it is. Suddenly we're in somewhere where we have to engage with other people, where we can't control anything. And that brings out a very different side to people's personalities, I think. And it's really interesting to watch that interaction and see how they negotiate those spaces. That's where the poetry comes from, for me anyway.
And will you continue to focus on motorway? I mean, do you do this sort of forensic process with other subjects?
I've got a few places on the A-Rose to visit now. There's one particular cafe in East Anglia, which is the central point on the trucking route from Carriage to Dunleary. Holyhead. And lots of things happen there. I'm going to do some work there. The other thing I'm working on is the interior qualities of some of London's unknown public spaces. So that's the next thing I'll be looking around. You might find me at North Greenwich Tube Station.
Are you working
against the blue mosaic?
With Thames, aren't you, on something in London?
I can't discuss it. I'm doing some work with Art on the Underground as well at the moment.
And have you got a book you want to come out?
Yes, this is the book. The book cover's actually in the presentation, but this is the thing that came out of all my travels. So it's called Food on the Move. Special price tonight, especially for 20th Century Society people. And what was nice about this, apart from the fact that it was a lot of fun doing it, there's a chapter with Richard Wentworth, the sculptor, which is a kind of phenomenological odyssey around the motorways. And then there are contributions. Alain de Botton talks about his first date. He's in here. Someone writes about from here to there in the lick of a little chef lollipop. Speed and Body in the Little Chef by the bloke that runs the Bartlett School of Architecture. Oh, and Laurie Taylor from the radio, who talks about meeting people at the Little Chef too. So it's lots of fun. And nice pictures as well.
This one, which is
also fantastic.
And the special price tonight is £10 rather than the RRP, which is £12.95. So it's special price.
Copies at the door.
Do you think that might be a fitting time to ask Jennifer to would you like to tell us? Well, you've told us about the poem. Would you like to just?
Do you want me to perform it now?
To perform it, yeah. Mm-hmm. Reiterate anything?
Maybe, yeah.
Okay. Do you want the book?
No, I need to read the whole poem, which
is 12. Tell us just a quick, you gave it a context earlier, but what's reproduced in this book is a part.
It's the first poem.
It's the first poem in a series, isn't it?
Yeah. You might have to show it now, I think you can do that, will you?
Very much to each of you for coming to talk. That was very interesting. I hope you guys have seen.
Oh, of course. Thank you.
Yeah.
In this lull, on an architectural note, and I'm just interested to ask you, because you probably know better than me, but I'm under the impression that the first sort of motorway service station was on the A1, near Doncaster,
yes.
With a bridge designed by Poulsen.
Yes.
Who then disgraced himself later on.
Yeah. And it was copied from a Howard Johnson's in the United States. Yeah.
Good.
With a plastic roof.
Is that okay?
See, yeah. I knew you'd know that. Good. It's not there anymore, is it?
Yeah. It's called Barnsdale Barn. It's a little bit.
And they are now being lifted, of course.
Yeah.
The ones on the one at Market.
Yes.
The
big excitement is going across the bridge. Not just because I used to clean one, but I mean, it's magical.
So as Naomi said, the first poem is in the book. There are actually 12 poems, and as you'll see from your little programme, the titles of the poems, and I've reproduced them, are read by Audrey. Audrey is an electronic voice, which is why I've given you the titles of the poems, because Audrey's not necessarily very clear, but she was off the internet. There was other unsavoury options for Audrey, which we decided not to do. The poem is made up of, as I said before, a composer who I worked with. We did some field work. Originally, it was written for a festival called the Cross Genre Festival that happened at Greenwich University a couple of years ago. I'm not sure there's really much else I need to say about it, actually. Is that okay with the sound? Is that okay? Are people hearing me okay? Is that okay? Yeah. So I should say, oh no, Audrey says it, it's fine.
Steel girded her musical in several parts. Her anatomy split of wild discourse.
Introducing La Lady Tray Ordinaire et Plastique, open wide for business, fun blasts and cleaning products, bust the glass up in this niche of geographic depression. Head of Magrot, Thatcher, 6687, or bust of Adonis, Lord, who was prohibited from urination despite funny walking and covert clutching. The rats, be happy. Human free, here where Julie, the place is fucking firing up your pantry, it burned up, down, don't you know? Do you need hot water and towels for birthing canal? No. Robbie Williams sings cracked in the car park, gives local access a big problem for piggy wigs. Of many there are, on chairs, eating enormous ice buns, looking for the criminal accent of acronyms and continents, or exulting an egg on plate. Here the kids saw Robbie, who'd have thought it, and real EastEnders and real Ian Sinclair and some real nobody writhing in a backseat penning a tortured heart rhymer into top shelf filth about horses. Blogging, fluffy bear and wrens and wagtails in glass penetration of natural light, the trees are on the inside, as is the newscasting for 14 Star Lou Awards. Send that postcard. Wear a uniform and what's that Yap Huan wit hat soap to? Smuggling the vodka in oversized Alice mugs, tripping through the ornamental maze, and advice on yellow food. Humanely fearless rats endorse the website, quoting the midwife, am I going mad or is this really happening? With three question marks. You're getting a picture now, right? Of metal art rafters up. Glass to them, rats aground, pillars of news and plastic chairs with our heroine here, where the A1M can meet the M25 and they make dirty love under the thin light in all day's rooms, among the dried biscuits. Survival will be on condiments only, but wait, a chopper. This is the erstwhile intro of place, famous, faced for anonymous and democratic need to pee. It is the spot an ordinary woman climbs upon a plastic table from plastic chair, steadies her heels, looks ahead and is cleaved in two, a mid-air cartoon pause before dropping to the left half, a weakly victim of masculogic, limp hands still outstretched to steady, the other half a police person of language, flat,
floor was uniformed and truncheoned for the faux furred. So, two rubbery skin images crumpled either side on quick clean tiling.
When we imagine the revolution, version 3.2.
The kitchenista, proud, tall, womb removed, lifts out feather-spouting lips, speaks. An empty car park stretches my spine over South Mim service station, where fun is terrific and organically your fingernail SIM cards delight the skin hoist sensitively near his edges. He battles straight, bristling, all centred on phallic plants behind the grasp of your new breakup. We laugh. There's nothing else to do. There is still coffee. Is this an audience? There's certainly a spacious sheet she burrows in, where things happen to other paper cups in novels unread. I'm glancing at the way you look at her. We're all so vain, even the breasts always moving at an alt rhythm to other body bits on the line. You tell her quite seriously that the walls are heart-rending magnolia remain. Morning will come, train, car, bus, slug with the RAC man. We wait, he, she, it will wait. Then he asks about her childbearing lips, and the kittenista screams, how? Arms raised, bangles rattling, do we all keep walking upright? If South Mim's plastic backbone is its unique tarantella, if dancing hard on the hill near bus stops would pale gestation time, Winner's breakdown cover he counsels for divorce and carburetor and misfiring, could there be a different exit where Luke W. fell off the digital clock face, a saddlebag twisting about his knuckles, ready to kick off? The kittenista scowls. Crap is poetic provenance. Even a novel, for fuck's sake, turns her third tummy stone. Muffin tops layered with chalky facial moulds start exploding. A woman lifts her skirt to the drinks dispenser. The repairman's nape spills some pink feathers twitch. She's going to speak, majestic, between a silver-grey Mondeo and a Ford Focus. Jackknife your dreams into the solar anus. There's more to South Mims than this. Lo, the Big C Research Centre lies aloft. The RAC man transforms into a mooncuff. Expansion is our aim. We believe in concretization for the people. Express feedback on customer toilet habits for back-of-house operations, self-clean floors, and properly popular music. The people have spoken. I am the will of them whose needs I speak from prejudice.
Everyone sings a lullaby. You are my fuckling, my only fuckling. I love you long time. When skies are grey, I'll never grow. Now that we're near London, please don't take my fuckling away. You tasted the inside of her thigh. In car parks in the cold, watching the coffee ring laminate tables move concentric like the place is being gutted, we say to each other. Unsure who did the physical work of introducing Beyonce to George Bataille, Mary Wollstonecraft to Catherine M. Real lifers who don't look like their internet pics, but dead, a couple of them. But we're delighted, welcome their support at South Mims SS, where assemble a force of unlikelies. Some kissing cheeks of Marmite.
There will be a shipwreck, nameless.
Some vintage in furs. A washed and shiny, shiny sun shimmer on the brow. The faint nostrils, which we pucker attractively in pranayama pelvic cuffs, means there's even space to things. The smooth skin from navel to perineum, under just right males, we shan't shit no more. Fuck, I prefer not to passively resist. We will not move, only breathe. For the babies in furs, for the animals in furs. A sheep in mink longs for your future. We know words quite right, needing work now. I stutter to say I want less than violence and more.
The invention of space.
Scare anybody.
Caitlin is still our tour.
Point left with finger sign, glass panes by hot pot plants, shroud obelisk hose into coronation chicken plinth, our plinth with standing poet plinth, dusty podium with poet plinth, poet place for you and poet you and plinth, breathe here, stretched plinth with friends, replete under high plinth, deserted plinth, old man atop plinth, lonely landed plinth with patio. Now Kittenista points to jump, electrode poet plinth, until jump poet, jump plinth, jump poet, move, circle, jump poet, plinth, steady, jump, circle, friend, plinth, ECT poet, alive poet, Kittenista, sorrowful. The language in front fails to jump them off plinth and captures their writing into future history, the delayed gratification recognised dead.
Everyone stops singing and there is silence for 21 of my heartbeats. Optics.
Screaming into the creamy phone disconsolately, a man's sweat sings. There's something I need to tell you about the car park. There's a part of me repulsed by weakness and a part of me weak. There's space at the end of my cavity for Mr. Biggles Bunny. There's nothing quite like Maltesers. There's a part of me that just watches with a slight sneer. There's you, there's Wally, there's South Moon Service Station. There's waiting for he, she, it to go down, off, skiing. There's the new year. There's bedroom for that kind of thing.
Sanity's bare.
Workshop on how to get stabby with knives reassures only that the poster's claim of alive and fabulous applies today as much as bygones to the antinomic pressure cooker. Lentil soup enrolled here. The legal writ, numbers with pixeled police, tracing the kettle and cordon in firebrand, ashes to dusty plastic chairs rooted each a distance calculated to prevent touch, N. Presentation of a case study. When for Monday, how full is your bucket, is required reading at the Ministry of Justice. The white collars walk out along the M1 way because chapters entitled Positivity, Negativity and Productivity spell privatisation and big society is all your faulty thinking and doing a deferral of blame and ice cream and when giving compliments is reconfigured as increased working capacity because we all need best friends, hint, learn their name, and shit, just imagine what your world would be like 1 year after you've engaged in daily bucket filling. And you want to stab those friends and customers and colleagues and wife and self-help culture, winding up sectioned and vulnerable over the MOJ line. Get me out of here, I want to get back to China. There's an irony here. Sincere and meaningful bucket filling, and here, increases the morale of any organisation, and creating this difference can be inexpensive or even free. Go create, initiativise, but not too much. Do not change beyond our expectations. We expect yours to be low. Smile at everyone, don't forget their name, and we can deliver real results to mental health tribunals as the moon calf trumpets. On which side are the mad?
Get up off your mat and soaking walk, my son. 397 BN by profit. 800,000 by line.
What's a billion in seconds? What's a life if I have one? What's a 12-hour working day? Yeah, like I do that. Out of choice. Not TikToks, not your screwy brother love. Not for companies and safety prayers of progress and an Asian industrial revolution eventually and family and future. No. Fuck, no. I can't but can live, sleep, eat, knowing that bones not of mine don't resist this with every bit of them, not made by Venter for this the week, the way that some people die walking out off a life, because a walkout can be more than a picnic or a fat willy, however slimy. And sometimes I want to vomit in my food and yours, which is waste's fruity gesture. But as I type, people work making it, and I make fuck all typing this. And there's no bottom line for my kind of hypocrisy, or for the happiness of my life. Except that people die for it, but not in my name, only in theirs. And what the fuck is there to do in the face of that? There's always a dissonant enjambment and a gospel choir beneath your bed.
Training only, or just stick pointers.
Community transmutes Arcadian nostalgia where equitable taxes imply homogeneity, when resistance translates violence and harm, why knowledge traces specialisation against democracy, traduces critical theory into practical paralysis, why happiness trespasses upon...
Is the sweetheart you married the husband you expected him to be?
Trespasses upon accusations of complacency.
Has the war created new problems for you in your marriage?
Complacency for personal responsibility trembles into government laxity. What community collaboration calls protectionism, which transposes reactionary immigration regulations when multiculturalism threatens feminism and democracy is not fulfilled people with standards of living to celebrate and creativity, transfigures into people, personalities applause, and advancing dissent permits other repression. And personal license stomps over communal living, and the West risks very little.
Massaging our digressions.
Closure is an overvaulted difficult, perhaps too a question of taste. In Mao's bitter conquest, there is no South Nim's revolution today, or architecture would be different. I want to be decomposed by this and you, where fire does not switch to comfort. We creatures create much we dislike and then sit on it. How to stay alive? Ours is a lividity awaiting someone to have a better idea. In this car park, in the cold, with the remnants of a woman's voice and unsteady arms, no hands of right here. Only injustice marked and marking the place irrecoupable through satire's poignard or laughter's empty consensus. I want. He, she, it wants a difference. Us rejects of repressive desublimation, awaiting and thinking, and not yet despairing in the face.
Contributors here, the book is good. So,
there you are.
Thank you, Naomi.
Thank you, everybody,
thank
very
you.
Much. I didn't ask the questions because I thought actually, not this time.
Well, okay. Okay.
Unless somebody wants got something really burning. Sorry, that was.
There's a cream for that, yeah.
burning.
What did I find in the bins? Poetry. Condoms. Chewing gum in every colour of the rainbow. Phone numbers. Past lives and future lives. And a lot of fang packets.
One thing I wanted to ask, you talked about the social and political elements of motorways, but I mean, just going to these excellent images on the screen, nobody has quite touched yet on, I mean, the word poetry has been mentioned, but a lot of my friends think I'm crazy because I do find motorways and service stations quite exciting, glamorous places, and you mentioned West London, and I know Westway very well. Mm. Driving down it sometimes at night, it's like being in a movie sometimes. Do you think that's one of the things that informs the sort of almost the glamour of motorways? The fact that one can get a curious excitement out of it.
Yeah, and there's a video playing over there of the film Radio On made by Chris Pettit in 1979, which that's as close as we get in this country, I think, to a road movie. And because it's a small country and it seems like there's nowhere really to go, it's very easy to get to most places, or it seems quick. We don't really think about the experience of actually travelling, and I think Jennifer talked about being 2.5 hours from Leicester to South Mins.
Right.
Jennifer in her car with her friend listening to the music or the conversation, that is a space, and that's part of that romance. It's their private space for that time.
He was reading bits of The Wire and it was awful.
You need to choose your company.
My composer, what can I do?
Oh, your composer.
He was ridiculing it, nevertheless. It was a very boring day.
Driving away from home 40 miles or more, isn't it?
He's determined not to like them.
That's fine. I've converted Tupper.
But, I mean, there's an image of Hopper up there. There is a Hopper-esque element sometimes to late night.
Ballard's Crash is very much about the kind of West Way experience.
And I think that's, having come from West London and not really going to these places until later on, it became a kind of a fetish for me to go and see these places that I've been prevented from seeing. And I think, again, it's about looking hard and looking in the bins and looking at the people, and that's where the glamour starts to come through, in seeing that poetry underneath the surface of a kind of corporate life. Below the kind of spray-painted surface of the car, you've got all the oily mechanics, and it's the oily mechanics that I'm interested in at the service station.
But also, the oily mechanics and visuals in the film, Ian Borden is bringing out a book very soon, I think in November, it's due to be published on Drive. Which sounds a very, very interesting book, and it's all about the vernacular of the road movie. And in fact, movies as a road movie, not just road movies, as a genre, if you can call movies a genre, are littered with a sort of background working parts, visuals and background, just resonances of roads, through car windows and rear view mirrors, and it's littered everywhere. It's like, multi-story car parks, underground car parks, the number of times they appear in movies is just phenomenal. It's hundreds and hundreds of examples. And likewise with roads, they just appear everywhere. They're part of our everyday visual vernacular. They're there in their sort of collective subconscious almost.
One of the best theatre performances I ever went to was from the Battersea Arts Centre, where you could only have three people at any time experiencing the performance because it took place in a car. And you were driven around in various crazy ways. The two people in the front were the actors and the three people in the back were the audience. And your designation was to kind of meet in a car park behind Boots in the dark, winter. It was kind of a bit creepy, really. But it was an amazing performance, but also the rear view mirror, because my experience as the obviously you could see the road and where you were going and what was going past, but you're trying to see the actors, and of course they've got their backs to you. And so I ended up feeling like a child again when you're in the back seat and you're trying to figure out what's going on with the people in the front seat. And so you're kind of looking in all these mirrors that reflect in various different ways to get the angle of what's going on. And it was fascinating because it took you back to that experience of being right in the back seat.
What were the actors doing? What were the actors doing in this performance?
Well, there was it was a performance of Pinocchio. Pinocchio, I think it's called Pinocchio in the Blue Fairy. It wasn't really a performance of Pinocchio, it was quite experimental. I don't know if you know Shunt, but one of the actors, at least one of the actors, was a Shunt actor, very physical. So at one point we were in Battersea Park and one of the actors was on top of the car and the car was careening around and we were given a safe word. Well, we were given a safe word at the beginning of the performance that if we wanted it to stop, if we felt uncomfortable, we could say the safe word. So it was quite edgy at some points. But it was really good. But they were having a conversation. There was recorded music, I think, that was on the radio. They were arguing a lot of the time, which was where the tension of trying to figure out what was going on happened. But there was certainly one who was more dominant and one who was naughty.
I keep bringing it back to the 18th century, but I think parallels can be drawn with all this rear view mirror and the wing mirrors and the way they're used and the way they see themselves in the middle of it. That's the whole place. the quotes, but as a frame of the glass.
So what
they for the glass, as a frame of the glass for landscape depiction. They do, they ready the frame on landscape glass, but it fizzes and disappears in the rear view mirror. Mm-hmm. It's there.
This is the amulet, and it's right to point out the difference between the experience of nighttime driving and daytime driving.
Oh, absolutely.
And certainly when I was, there was a time when I'd go to Liverpool quite a lot. Rightly or wrongly, I went to Liverpool, that's something else. But you find yourself saying, oh, well, I could leave now, or I could have supper in Liverpool. And then sometimes you find that there are people who are going back to London. They say, can I have a lift? And I say, well, you'd be quicker on the train, because you want to travel alone. Really selfish. But then you have choices. You know very well that there are some motorways with more artificial lights than others. The M40 is not good.
Yes.
So actually the M1 is better.
Yeah.
And you find but you're alone with the radio, which is very important.
Yeah.
Probably leaving actually very little on the road after about 10:30 at night. Not much on those highways. And you just drive, and actually you can get back from Liverpool to London in 2.5 hours, quicker than the train.
It's interesting that it's a hostage space, the car, because if you were to catch a train with somebody that was that long distance, it wouldn't be rude to get out a book and just say, I'm going to read now. You might have initial conversation, but you could. But in a car, because one person is active.
Sure. No, I hate passengers.
Yeah, exactly. You want them to just go, I'd like to get out a book now, or, but they don't. They feel like
you've
got the floor.
You can switch on.
It's really
horrible. Switch to a bit of music if you want. Although I prefer someone talking to me, because actually I don't listen. And then your mind goes off into other places, and actually you can have some of your best.
Lucky you, I just know loads about milk farming in Wales and all the other obscure programmes.
I can
radio
sport producer
that.
That
I seem to be driving.
But it's quite good, but music is it's too engaging. It takes you somewhere which is maybe a good place, but not actually where you want to be.
But Will, you don't like passengers as a driver.
Mm-hmm.
Not as another passenger.
Well, I love being a passenger, I just want to sleep.
Yes, there is that bubble that one experiences, and one that really, again, we've probably, particularly people who drive, probably have this experience of driving down the road. You do get in, particularly high-speed trunk roads mostly, you are in a bubble. Paul Virilio talks about this notion of travel where arrival and destination and departure are privileged over the idea of journey. Because the journey, in a sense, is this sort of transit zone. It's this weird bubble of forgetfulness.
I think it's quite scary.
And people do suffer amnesia. Fall asleep or don't remember. Oh, what was doing last half hour? I've been driving and they haven't crashed and they're still okay. And people do have this strange sort of like midway between sleeping and being awake.
That's true, but they are very safe places.
They are very safe places.
Statistically speaking, in deaths and serious injuries on road, the highways are the safest. Yeah, and the country
has that been true? Has that always? Has that been true for long? Because it seems to me that there were many more major crashes
Early on, yeah. I had to go on a re-education course for speeding.
Oh, you too!
And they tell you these things.
Yeah. Oh, they tell you all sorts of things.
I was fascinated. I thought it was very...
I had to have one as well.
Let me on it.
Really? You have one?
Yeah, no, it was all... Because they make you confess at the beginning. I don't know if anyone's been done for speeding.
But
I was done for speeding. And they go around the room and they make you confess. And you have to say why you were speeding. And so it kind of feeds into this narrative of some sort of moral framework. And I said, well, I was speeding because my grandmother had just died and I wanted to get to my mother and I'm going to do it again and I don't care. And I'm sorry it was outside of school. It was 7 o'clock at night. There was no one there. It's definitely the wrong answer.
What speed? What speed were you driving?
Oh, it was a 20 zone in normally a 30 road because it was near a school. And I was about four over, which is why I got the re-education course.
Yeah.
Not
you were doing 120 or something?
No, I was doing it, but I was...
It's quite a
media fan, I mean.
They were very, yeah.
This seems a bit harsh, anyway.
Oh, I had 2 nights of it. It was amazing, it was full of taxi drivers who were furious.
I found a fascinating experience, because, the simulation bit, I don't know whether we experienced the same thing, but it's all on the screen, and you had to stop and if you had to decide.
Was yours in the
people.
South? Mine was in Leicester in a terrapin
mine.
Building. There was none of this simulation. There was just a really patronising woman
no,
who said, really, makes you think, doesn't it, every few minutes.
No, it was very, very, very good. And actually, afterwards, it sort of worked for about 3 months. And then you sort of become a bit lax. Quite good, quite enjoyable. It's better than
quite
the 3 points
drive.
In your life.
Yeah, they're extraordinary places.
But I was surprised how many people were there.
People from all walks of life. Mm. The first question people ask.
There's a gentleman over there.
You spoke a lot about service stations as social spaces and the insides of cars as social spaces, but you were sort of just starting to touch on the motorway itself as a social space vis-à-vis relations between cars in a strange kind of autistic setup. And I wonder if you had any thoughts about that.
I know one of the things I wanted to say, but then you just gave me the excuse to say it, is that I would, if I had the energy, I would like to organise all 15.4 million people along the M62 one day to walk along it and get rid of all the. Because you'd experience it at a different pace, which none of us
have
experienced.
No, I have. I cycled it actually as a kid.
On the motorway?
On the motorway. Before it was opened, it was completely built, just the odd police patrol car. And I used to dive into central reservations, the political height, behind the barriers, with your little rally bike. I cycled all the way from Elland all the way down to Bury. Mm. In the fast lane. Very, very slowly.
There was a guy
these
in
people
the
who
the
whole length
of the John Jones in the book. Yeah. No, but the experience is—it's not about being obsessive. The experience is quite—it's quite spectacular.
Well, it's the open road.
The relationship to landscape and space is so peculiar and so different from a car. And in fact, if you ever stop on the motorway, and you realise how fast and how aggressive and how.
It's
a really I once broke down on the motorway on the hard shoulder, but it's actually an active lane, and so I had to there's nowhere I could go basically. The car's driving the back of me, and fortunately there were bollards around because some roadworks, and then the time it took me to get out of the car, walk a few hundred yards back to place some bollards
in your hard hat
and
your reflective
equipment. No, I had a try. This is before my interest. I did a triangle. I put the triangle out. People were tooting me, beeping. I put the triangle down on the road, and I was driven into eight cars, and I think three articulated lorries nearly drove into the back of me, and one actually smoked me out the wheel. My goodness, and I had a young child at the time. If the child had been in the car, could have easily been killed. And I just thought, what horrible, dangerous places they are. They're really, really dangerous. And I got a better car after that.
That's a good idea. We didn't really answer your question at the time, but the notion of personal space is, generally speaking, outside, we're talking about motorways. Motorways are a retreat for some people, and it gets away, and it is a form of private space, which we are sadly lacking in many, many, many places. And we often talk about public space, and again, I'm talking more generally and how important public space is. But actually, there's nowhere to sit, there's nowhere to do nothing, and so. And then you get to another sort of level. You think, well, picnics are quite good, aren't they? You try and find a good picnic space.
Exactly.
It's quite hard. Oh, some people don't care, unlike your chaps in your motorway, two Germans. But in a way, that is a sort of choice. I think the selection of picnic spot. And then, of course, you do find a good one of the streets, and then you're left with your modern car. It doesn't do what the old cars used to do.
Right, right down.
No, one of the things the old cars did, you lift the seats up.
Yeah.
Because the most comfortable seat you have
is the
seat you have.
I like to drive in a Morris Minor. I've broken down a lot on motorways.
Then you can choose your view for the comfortable seat, and it's better. Actually, they're better designed seats than the sofa or armchair in your home. They are.
Yeah.
I'm fine.
Actually, all that breaking down was a social space, isn't it? Mm-hmm. My dad's mended many fanbergs.
Yeah.
My mum's tight.
Yeah.
You know.
Where did your mum say that?
I spent it with my mum for my own time.
That's right.
That's good.
I think, have you ever motorway flirted?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a personal question, but anyone here, I know. Because if you're stuck in traffic all the time, which when I commuted from Brighton to Middlesex, you have to go up the M23, then the M25, then the M40, and then the North Circular. It's just a killing journey. But we would sit on the M25 for at least probably 40 minutes, and then if you were really unlucky, you'd be sitting again on the M40 for 30 minutes. And people flirted with each other, and people did extraordinary things. People were reading novels, people were eating their breakfast. Many women were doing their makeup. In fact, I used to do my makeup. I have to go for 5 o'clock. So I do my makeup in the car as soon as I hit the really serious traffic. And so people were using the spaces, but it was quite communal in a way. People were
that's
annoyed with each other, but also
a traffic jam.
When things stop,
normal motorway use strikes me, and you just thought of it as being a bit like the debate around gun ownership in the States. Mm-hmm. You've got a gun and I've got a gun. We both got a car. Mutually assured destruction. That means.
We're all going to be safe.
If somebody gets out of their car, as you did, suddenly you're not safe because I've got a gun and you
are. There are.
When it slows down to a certain speed, there becomes a social space.
And it's also the most dangerous time
as
well.
When it stops completely, people actually start getting out of their cars and start talking to each other and wondering what's going on and all that kind
of
stuff.
And that's what I remember being, just traffic has completely stopped with some presumably bad accident. It probably wasn't, but police close motorways at the drop of a hat these days. And it was on the M1, came back, and it was during one of the World Cups. And I'm not showing up, but I did have a television in my car.
Now that is dangerous.
And we were going, no, it didn't work if you were moving.
Really? What car have you got?
Anyway, we were there for a serious amount of time, and the match I wanted to see at home was on in my car.
Was it in the back of
the car? And then people said, they suddenly, my neighbours became one of those.
Oh, so
they come jump in. The sitting room on the M1.
Fantastic.
It was good. And everyone was quite jolly.
I mean, what is staggering is if traffic does actually stop, and everybody stops, so there isn't this aggression, and everybody switches the engine off, and you realise the landscape that is around you, it really is phenomenal. It is beautiful, and it frames everything. And usually it's just a green strip, a ribbon of green, flying past very quickly. You don't really notice the details apart from the signs and a few landmarks. When you stop, you realise the amount of wildlife and the amount of wildflowers and insects and things that are actually thriving there, because they're the buffer zone between this little tarmac piece of ground and the hard shoulder and agrochemical countryside, which is on the other side, and this bit of green, which is untouched and untrodden, and we don't really have access to, no legal access anyway, is left.
Is it owned by the motorway?
It's run by the highways agency.
Yeah.
And Richard Mabey described it as Britain's largest unofficial nature reserve. It's upwards of 40,000, upwards of 1,000 hectares of land, which is massive. So it will be Britain's biggest nature reserve. Mm.
And on that note, please go up to that print and have a good close look at it, because it's lovely.
It's a beautiful print.
It's beautiful, isn't it? Do you want a fag?
Yeah, I do.
Thank you, Naomi.
Are you on that?
Hello.
Hello.
He's back.
Oh, I'm in. Okay.